I'm Christopher Lydon, talking about a transnational America with Donald Pease of Dartmouth, who says it's the next big idea in American cultural and political studies. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, from the Watson Institute at Brown University. This one is about the master narrative of the U.S. in the world. And there are a lot of dots to connect in this fall of 09, even around President Obama's rethinking of the confrontation he inherited in Afghanistan. Is the story a clash of civilizations? Is it us against them? Is it do it to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban before they do it to us again? Or could it be us with them? Us for them? And what does it have to do with how you read Moby Dick, Melville's whale novel from 1851, a parable of America in danger, many have said, or with its global crew of sailors on the whale ship Pequod, and with those exotic heroes aboard like the South Sea pagan Queequeg? Did America in that Moby Dick parable stand for something more universal, something, in a word, transnational? Donald Pease, you've made waves with this idea that there's a shift underway in the narrative of America on campuses. How is the changing master story going to reach the culture in general? The supermarket, the factory, the tavern, Wall Street, Main Street, or has it already?
I think that Obama is one of the figures through whom this transformation is taking place. He has positioned himself at the site of the deepest rift in the Janus face of America. Hmm. America is simultaneously the most lonely of superpowers that wants to enforce the rule of law across the globe. That's America constructing itself as an exception to the laws of nations. Then there's the other face of America, which is as the most open and non-integrative, non-assimilative of public spheres. It's a nation of immigrants, but it is a nation that is also hospitable to persons from across the planet. And when Barack Obama goes to Europe and positions himself as the other side of American exceptionalism. He says, I'm an American exception. Nobody with my story could have become the leader of the free world anywhere but in America. But at the same time as he says that, he then dissociates himself from the position of America as the enforcing exception and instead identifies himself as a cosmopolitan, as a citizen of the world, as a figure who wants to become part of the conversation of cultures across this planet. And he becomes thereby a figure who is not merely representing America to the world. He's also a figure who's bringing the world to America and letting America know that the world has always already been in America.
It's a funny tension, but it's a perfect cue to the speech he gave in Berlin during the campaign, and I think we should just listen to it, and then you can pull it apart. This was Barack Obama, not yet nominated, but on the way, digressing to Berlin in July 08, speaking to a huge crowd in the Tiergarten.
I come to Berlin as so many of my countrymen have come before. Although tonight I speak to you not as a candidate for president, but as a citizen. A proud citizen of the United States and a fellow citizen of the world. I know that I don't look like the Americans who've previously spoken in this great city. The journey that led me here is improbable. My mother was born in the heartland of America, but my father grew up herding goats in Kenya. His father. His father, my grandfather, was a cook, a domestic servant to the British. At the height of the Cold War, my father decided, like so many others in the forgotten corners of the world, that his yearning, his dream, required the freedom and opportunity promised by the West. And so he wrote letter after letter to universities all across America until somebody, somewhere, answered his prayer for a better life.
There's the transnational Obama at a critical moment, and he never looked happier about saying those words. So many connections. He's a refugee, in a sense, from the colonial world. He's Kansas. He's sensitive to the indignity of being a servant in the British Empire. But no more of that. America answers a prayer for a better life. To me, the beautiful thing there is that he held up America not as a world leader, much less a world ruler, but as the world's story. Mm-hmm. He ran as a transnational leader. I thought it was very daring at the moment. Can he govern that way? Can he preside that way?
Those are a series of very important questions, and let me go to the first one and take off from there. When Obama goes to Berlin, the Berlin Wall is no longer there, and he's deliberately contrasting his salutation from his most vivid predecessors, Kennedy and Reagan. He doesn't say, as Reagan did, tear down this wall, and he doesn't say, as Kennedy did, ich bin ein Berliner. He instead identifies himself as at once a citizen of America and a citizen of the world, but a world that now dreams once again for an America that can become what could be called a transnational utopia. Not an America that will be the European's dream of a fresh start for the West in a new world, but for figures across this planet who shared the dream of his father for a mobility and an authority and a freedom that he believed he could only achieve by accomplishing the transition, the transit from his homeland through America and then his return to his homeland. Obama, in the circulation of the dream of his father, is the figure through whom his father can return with a sense of dignity that he may not have achieved were it not having passed through the image of his son who bore his dream and turned it into the reality of change is going to come. Obama was two dreams. He was the dream that has been dormant and endlessly deferred in America, perhaps since the Civil War, for a completely multiracial, utterly free, and totally multicultural social order, non-hierarchical. He is a figure who, when having moved from the aspirations of his Kenyan father to the dream of his 68 mother. His mother comes from the dream of 1968. And he correlated those two dreams into a passion to become, as he ran for president, a signifier of a floating signifier. You could project, as he was running for president, whatever fantasy you wanted for change onto Barack Obama. He did not materialize, fixate, or specify, particularize the fantasy that he solicited from all of the figures who wanted him to bring about change. Once he became president, however, he had to transpose what could be called a multi-directional dream, a multiple fantasy, into a specific policy of leadership. And that required him to take some very strong stands and to establish a distinction between himself and his predecessor, George Bush. The most important distinction he established was the distinction between what he called overseas contingencies operations and Bush's global war on terror. The global war on terror was what transposed the United States into the sole superpower of the planet, with the capacity in the name of searching out terrorists to control, as if it's the new definition of sovereignty, all the circuits of interconnection across the planet. In a global economic order, the figure who can control all the circuits of interconnectivity is the figure who has the keys to sovereignty. When Obama dissociated from Bush's global war on terror, he produced a face for the world that some political realist calls the soft face of American power, the ideals of America. But he simultaneously did something that he didn't plan to do. What George Bush knew when he constructed the global war on terror is that by doing that, he would be able to take all of the unruly elements in the national order, the national militia, which became associated with the Blackwater military group, militia groups in Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan, as well as the religious fundamentalists, and position them as allies in the war on terror, the global war on terror. When Obama eliminated the enemy, the universal enemy, the terrorist, he produced internally the rift that is now resulting in all of the paramilitaries who otherwise would have remained aligned with the global war on terror, and all of the religious fundamentalists to construct a conjoined fantasy of Obama as a man who could not possibly be president because he could not possibly have been born in America. The fantasy that's being constructed of Obama, the transnational American leader, is of an immigrant without his papers who not only shouldn't be president, but who should instead be construed as a soft terrorist. Obama lost the capacity that George Bush had mobilized to transform internal enemies into an ally in a global war. Because he has dissociated himself from the global war, he's now subject to all of the forces that were controlled domestically by that war.
Donald Pease, this is fascinating and a little bit scary. I thought it was gutsy for Obama to run openly, as in that Berlin moment, as the transnational candidate. How did he lose that standing as president?
He didn't lose the standing as president, but the right is now saying that he belongs to, in quotes, foreign nations. He is not really American. The transnational in Obama is read by chauvinists, nativists, first America firsters, religious fundamentalists, militia groups, as a way of being soft on security, as a way of failing to protect and defend the homeland. 9/11 released a whole series of primal anxieties that, in a sense, George Bush mobilized and regulated with a global war on terror. When you dissipate that war and you say the globe is not a space that is terrorizing, but is instead a space in which persons from all over this globe can become partners in a transnational project to achieve the best aspirations of the planet, ecologically, militarily, economically, that figure becomes for America firsters who have been terrified into a complete identification with the homeland security, that project can be interpreted as the work of an enemy, as the work of a terrorist, which is how they're trying to construct him.
But how does he win the campaign in 08 against John McCain and seem to be losing the campaign, or in a scramble anyway, with the right as president?
He wins the campaign with John McCain primarily because of the subprime mortgage crisis, when all the credibility in the market is displaced from the market and confected onto a dream come true. you can see a deep association.
Translate cathected.
That means invested. It's a psychoanalytic term. It means taking the affective energies you would have given, say, to one love object and projecting them onto another love object. If the market and the home for the homeland became the primary locations for the American dream, when the subprime mortgage crisis hit, the American dream was looking for a dream object, and Obama was the dream object. If you noticed, after after those conventions, McCain was gathering force against Obama every week until the subprime hit. When the subprime crisis hit, the locus for American dreams, the credit, all of our sense of credit and credibility is also structured in our deep dream mechanisms. Obama is a man of dream. His father's dream, his mother's dream, his fans' dream, and he knows how to transpose waking dream work into a recognizable representation of a goal. So when Obama took the deepest American dream that everyone can achieve prosperity and said, I embody that, and linked it to the deferred dream, the raisin in the sun, one day, and then associated that with one of the most memorable of Sam Cooke's songs that became a kind of anthem throughout the 60s.
Change is going to come.
Change is going to come. He condensed all of those dream objects into a persona in which he didn't have to do anything but address his audience as you. You. However you project me, I will be that projection, that fantasy projection for you. When that fantasy projection was primarily successful, which was after the separation from the subprime credit crunch, all the credibility got reinvested in him. He was not defeatable. The Republicans ran a very savvy campaign. When John McCain constructed himself as the POW from Vietnam, he was trying to erase Abu Ghraib from public consciousness by saying, I am the figure they did it to. You cannot remember Abu Ghraib and hold the nation responsible when I eradicate that figure. He was working at the level of a dream figure. When they chose Sarah Palin, Sarah Palin becomes the equivalent of a pioneer mother, a pioneer woman. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan regressed the nation to the site of the colonial setters in relation with the Indians. That is, they regressed the American people to the position in which sheer aggression as a way of reappropriating dignity and position and home became the deepest affective resource. When Sarah Palin came in, she was the colonial mother. She was the colonial mother, the archetypal colonial mother. From the period of the Indian Removal Act, who said she would willingly sacrifice not only the son who was already in Iraq, but any child whom she bore in the name of the security of the homeland. So the Republicans were running a very smart fantasy campaign. And if you noticed, they also knew that the event that broke the back of the president was Hurricane Katrina. That's why Obama held the convention on the date of Hurricane Katrina, because that was literally the date at which the homeland became totally insecure. You saw an event in nature produce a homeland that was literally disappearing into the sea without the president doing anything to secure it. And when that event happened, the public suddenly disconnected from homeland security and reconnected to opposition to the war.
Donald Pease, this is completely fascinating. I thought you were a literary critic, and it turns out you're a psychoanalyst.
Well, literary critics are bed partners of psychoanalysts. You can't be a decent literary critic without believing, I think, in the psyche.
Listen, keep Obama and all those fantasies in mind, but I want to digress in a significant way to a book that I love and that you revived and reintroduced on the meaning of Moby Dick for modern Americans, the book being Mariners, Renegades, and Castaways, written by the late, great C.L.R. James. This, too, deals with the transnational idea and maybe the transnational reality today. C.L.R. James, black Trinidadian, a black nationalist, but also a devout scholar of English literature, an American, Melville, Thackeray above all. He wrote in this book on Moby Dick that the voyage of the Pequod is the voyage of modern civilization seeking its destiny. Ahab stood, as he always does, for a sort of totalitarian obsession. His white New England officers, like Starbuck and Stubb, turned out to be go-along guys, part of the problem. They could have prevented disaster, but they didn't in the James reading. Even Ishmael, who lived to tell the tale, was no hero in James's reading. He too might have stopped Ahab, but he caved in. The crew from every nation, corner of the world, yes, are the victims of the tale, but they're also the only heroes in it. Not just the most skillful seamen, but, as James writes, they were the most generous and magnificent human beings on board. And especially the South Sea cannibal, Queequeg, embodies the universal idea of skill, of courage, of heart. I want you to take that reading apart and relate it to Obama's world today, and maybe even, as I can't help doing reading Moby Dick, relate Obama to Queequeg.
Mm. That's a great question. When C.L.R. James decided to write his wonderful commentary on Moby Dick, he had been forcibly separated from his apartment by INS agents.
And this is 1951.
1952, June 10th, 1952. Men in black suits came to his apartment and told him that he had to go with them to Ellis Island and await a decision over his deportation because of the activist work he'd performed over the preceding 20 years. When C.L.R. James goes to Ellis Island, he doesn't simply take up the commentary where he left off. He experiences his having been forcibly dissevered from his home and placed on Ellis Island with expellees, outcasts, renegades, political prisoners from across the planet.
Which was the way Melville had described the crew of the Pequod.
Which was exactly,
that's his phrase, yeah.
That's exactly the way he had described. And he changes his entire position. When you are subjected to the full force of law by INS, and you don't have any right of habeas corpus, you don't have any right to defend you, you're no longer an I. What James does is he goes to the moment in Melville's text in which he feels that Melville has broken a promise to the reader, and he inhabits it, and he speaks the unspoken of Melville, and he describes the unspoken of Melville as this. Melville, in the passage in which he addresses the spirit of liberty, says he wants to make the meanest mariners, renegades, and castaways the true heroes of this book, which means he wants to enable them to revolt against Captain Ahab. He said that Melville had this intention, but he didn't achieve it because he was afraid of criticism.
He made it the great question of the book, is sort of why don't either the officers or the crew stop the madness?
Yes. He makes it the crucial question, but then he does something more than that. I can't emphasize this enough because it's the profound imaginative act he performs. He inhabits the deepest masterwork of American literary culture, a work that has been used by the State Department to spread Americanist values across the globe in the heyday of the Cold War, where Ahab's totalitarianism is understood to be opposed successfully by Ishmael's liberal democratic positioning. And this then becomes the predictor of America's success in the Cold War. What James does is he says that Ishmael is a version, an intellectual version of Ahab. He's not an opponent of Ahab, but that Ahab's capacity to arrive at decision is attractive to Ishmael because Ishmael can't decide. He's like he says he's like most liberal intellectuals who turn ambiguity and ambivalence into a political virtue. And James says this is precisely what allows a figure who is as totalizing in his will as Ahab to prevail. Ishmael needs the overdetermination of Ahab's indecisiveness in order to sustain his indecision, his attitude of indecision. What James does is he inhabits Melville's prose at a moment in which he's envisioning the lowest of the crew as the greatest tragic hero on the ship. What James sees that no one sees is that Melville has produced a desire for a transnational, multicultural, completely hospitable ship of state that only the mariners, renegades, and castaways can achieve.
There's that wonderful chapter 40 or maybe 41 in which sailors from all over the world, from the Netherlands, from Tahiti, from Mars practically, are all partying. And it's one of the great celebrations in the whole book. Connect that vision of the heroic castaways, that transnational crew, the only hero in the book, to the Obama vision of a transnational moment and transnational leadership.
When 9/11 produced a decisive change in American self-representation, it no longer was the virgin land. It was a land that was susceptible to injury, as all other lands on the planet had been. The nation was returned through that catastrophe to the deepest primal memories of America. What America was in the 1830s is what Bush recalled. But America, before it became integrated as a set of states, that differentiated Canada from the United States, from Mexico, from all of South America, was a space that was hospitable to every traveler from across the planet. America was the space for a new beginning, for a renewal of planetary existence for everybody across the globe. Whereas 9/11 awakened in Bush colonial aggression, that catastrophe simultaneously awakened the moment of the discovery, so-called, in which America became the locus, the transfer station for movements of every trade route and every form of travel across the planet. America, before it became, in quotes, the land of immigrants, was a completely open space for figures throughout the world. And that's what it's as if Melville, who feels the Civil War coming, you feel that he knows the war is coming, and he knows what that will mean. He knows that once the Civil War comes, that the imperial state formation, the North, will produce an imperial state formation that will produce an isolated nation. He knows that, and at the same time as he constructs a plot in which he shows the catastrophic outcome of that with Ahab, Ishmael, and Starbuck, he's producing at the same time this alternative to that, which is a space which is the space of open hospitality, endless hospitality to every stranger across the globe. That's the crew. James's vision of the crew is that they listen to Ahab go on and go on with his fiery comment, and then Then James says, then they go about what they do, which is what they love to do, which is the work that gives them their freedom and their life. For C.L.R. James, the crew paid no attention to Captain Ahab when it came to doing their labor. Yes. They only looked at him as a kind of public spectacle when he produced a scene that was so fixative they couldn't separate from it. Now, Ahab, Chris, is a figure that he's got the secret to oratory, in that if you really know an orator who is completely spellbinding is a figure who's not speaking to a public. He's speaking with all of the regulatory keywords that produces a public. He's producing as the force of speech rather than the communicative dimension of speech. And the crew feel compelled by his force, as if law is speaking itself. Law, unlike other speech acts, has the capacity to produce as a sentence a deed. A word becomes deed in law. Ahab speaks as the force of law, sentencing the men.
I want to come back to Barack Obama by a double digression, if I may, to Joseph O'Neill's novel, Netherland, which was a direct application of C.L.R. James's thinking to New York and the United States after 9/11. And we know that the president read Netherland and thought it was a terrific book. This is tricky because this is James, the cricket enthusiast. Mm-hmm. C.L.R. James, having grown up in Trinidad, mastered the colonists' game. Mm-hmm. And, of course, West Indian cricketers transformed the whole international competition. He adopted the game of cricket, James did, as a sort of framework of a world order built around rules and rivalry, but it gave space for upward mobility for the talented poor folk in the British Empire that they'd ruled in the Caribbean, in India, in Africa. Along comes Joseph O'Neill, the novelist, who's a cricketer himself. In Netherland, he uncovers an underground network of cricket players in New York, cricket leagues, and a great character, Chuck Ramkissoon, a Jamaican, who believes that America will find itself anew in a world by embracing cricket, the sport of the global era. Mm-hmm. And as I say, then we hear that President Obama is reading this book and saying great things about it. Decipher all that, all those messages about the transnational idea.
Let me make some linkages that you've made through the question. In a sense, C.L.R. James turned Moby Dick into a cricket game in which he added a new rule and played thereby a different end game. The rule prior to his reading that was that you can't read it in any way other than a way that ratifies the opposition between Ahab and Ishmael. He produced a secondary rule, and he allowed figures who had been unrepresented previously, the crew, to become the primary heroes. That's doing within a form of life called literature what James saw cricketers do on the cricket field, which he paid attention in cricket to the way in which a certain player's style of playing could result in the need to produce a new rule in cricket, where just the freedom of the way of playing by figures who were not over hyper-regulated by the rules of the game could add a play that required the production of a new rule, which was for C.L.R. James the manifestation of the freedom of the colonized other in relation to the colonizing power, because it was the way in which you subverted the British Raj, which is the other name for Ramkissoon.
Right. In the world of Barack Obama's father and grandfather,
and in the very name of following those rules, C.L.R. James sees cricket as a means of transposing a colonizing space. You learn cricket in order to become one of the civilized in the British Empire. He turns that space into a space in which you can redefine civilization to include everybody. Non-imperial civilization, a transnational civilization that is hospitable to unassimilable otherness. The deepest understanding of multicultural is unassimilable otherness. When you try to assimilate otherness to pre-existing categories, you deny the difference that an other makes to a culture. But the unassimilable otherness of the cricket field, of the Pequot, and of Barack Obama. If you take now the fantasy structure, what he's doing by refusing to be stably identified with any one figure is to become open to all forms of projective identification with him. That is, he is not assimilating to an integrative figure. He's soliciting all the world's dreams, where the son of a cook can produce a son who becomes the king of the world. Every man a king and every man a cook is James. Obama's hospitable openness to everyone is his way of saying anyone can become, if you really want to understand democracy, the lowest can become the highest. The last can hold the place of the first. That's the deepest dream of democracy. The last shall be first.
Utterly fascinating. But where are we, three quarters of a year into the age of Obama, in this dream? He's certainly meeting a lot of headwinds on the idea of a transnational America, a transnational presidency. What's taking hold? What's not?
Well, he's trying to do contradictory things. I mean, on the one hand, his major policy initiative is the healthcare initiative, which is to take care of the body politic of this nation, which has solicited his educating the nation in the ways in which most other countries across this globe have a healthcare policy that is more salutary, let's say, than the United States. That's a transnational gesture, but is a transnational gesture in the service of a national body, the health of the national body politic.
Go back to the transnational idea. You pictured it on the cricket field, on the Pequod, in Barack Obama's dreams. How does it stand at this point?
Well, one of the dimensions of the O'Neill novel that I love is its intent to take the New York City, which was originally the New Netherlands, and to imagine in the wake of the catastrophe archaic resources in the netherworld of his imagination. Almost every major figure in American literary history, Rip Van Winkle, Whitman, Melville, Emerson, Thoreau, make appearances, make cameo appearances in the book, but they're alongside figures from world literature who understand American literary productions to be deeply connected with the imagination, the non-territorializable, extraterritorial imagination called literature. When O'Neill turns the cricket game that he learns how to find his way to through Chuck Ramkisson, he's returning to a national pastime that preceded baseball. He's returning to a past in America that was transnational before it became nationalized through a sport called baseball. Cricket is the precursor for baseball, and it's the precursor for baseball that eliminated the distinctions between the game played in America and games played across this planet, cricket. So what O'Neill does is he also turns cricket into a portal that allows you to see that transnationalism is a deep dream of humanity that can sometimes get actualized in real fields of play.
Mm. But that's what I'm wondering. Where is that notion of a heroic global working class, an open community of skillful, hardworking, caring about each other kinds of people? They were all men in Melville, but they could be women too. That idea was somehow embodied by Barack Obama, and he won the campaign. Where is that ideal today?
The ideal is displaced primarily, or invested primarily, in the Green Revolution. The understanding that everybody across this planet is dedicated to the purpose of protecting it from the modes of environmental pollution that are produced by greed. The catastrophe that mobilizes the deepest resources of the transnational is the fear of a planetary catastrophe. And that also is deeply
that's
linked.
Good. You keep trumping yourself, Donald Pease. This is fascinating. No, I mean, that's really interesting. Go ahead.
No, that's and that planetary catastrophe is what's much more inclusive, let's say, than either 9/11, which is, after all, even though New York is a cosmopolitan, international, even transnational city, it was still represented as a wound to America, and it's also less restricted even than Melville's reimagining Noah's flood, reimagining the deluge in Moby Dick.
Are you thinking of what I'm thinking of, the description of the Nantucketers?
Yes.
who plow the sea.
Yes.
And who rule the terraqueous globe.
Yes.
As he said, and another Noah's flood wouldn't interrupt them for an hour.
These are stateless human beings.
I wanted to ask you, you know, what are the connections really between these sort of literary figures and real life? But I think you keep answering it. They're very tightly wrapped together.
I believe that great writing emerges in order to allow the inexpressible, unconscious, preconscious dimensions of lived experience to become suddenly apparent, revealed.
Hmm.
When a writer with the gifts of Melville or with the gifts of Joseph O'Neill can take an event, in the case of Melville, the actual existence of Moka Dick, who destroyed ships and was one of the legends of all of the seafarers in the Northeast, and transpose that figure into a means whereby he can draw out the deepest obsessions, the most profound insecurities of the political realm of the United States in the years between 1848 and 1851. He's doing something then that Joseph O'Neill does in the Netherlands, who also takes, I mean, the power of the Netherlands is that he takes recognizable traumas, historical trauma, and he links it to an everyday trauma, the loss, the separation from his wife, the separation from his child, the feeling that he's lost his bearings, that he no longer occupies even the body of a man without a sense that he's been dissevered from it. When he can produce all of those linkages in a work called Netherland, he's showing how a historical trauma of the magnitude of 9/11 can solicit as ways of responding to it the unacknowledged traumas all of us live.
Mm.
Trauma is a name for a dream wound, a wound that opens you to dream. Trauma is the portal to your dream life. And Netherland is a portal to his dream life, to O'Neill's dream life. The beauty of his writing is you feel it almost in every sentence that there is an unconscious reserve to the sentence that is simultaneously animating it, but refusing to be stabilized by it.
Donald Pease, you embody a kind of trend in American studies that's headed, you say, in a transnational direction. Are we all, is our whole culture still headed in a transnational direction? Can Obama govern as he ran as a transnational candidate? Or to put it in a very different way, can Americans embrace Queequeg as their sort of spirit leader in a global arena, in a global moment?
I believe that it's not a trend. The transnational is a fact of life. The disappearance of the Cold War enabled everybody to see that America was a node in a network of transcultural relays, economic circulation across the planet. Transnational isn't a trend. It's an accurate description of the way this planet insists in 2009. Barack Obama needs a global event. That is an event that is recognizable as an event that solicits the interest of everyone who is, as he puts it, a citizen of this planet in order to connect his person with his vision. The problem with what happened at the Olympics is I would like to think that as the underside of what he really can do. The reason that event was taken as such a terrible loss and a loss of face was because he was supposed to be the transnational leader who would immediately solicit everyone's agreement for whatever he asked. Mm. But he knew, or he should have known, that there were places in the Americas that needed the Olympics, both culturally and economically, much more than did Chicago. What he needs now, I deeply believe, Chris, is an event that requires Obama, a world event that requires Obama as the figure who can respond to it responsibly.
Like what?
Well, part of it is linked now to the so-called Green Revolution. I believe that if and when he goes to China, you will see, or I hope we will see, an event, an encounter take place that will spell out the significance of every country across this globe living for the sake of the Green Revolution. The Chinese are right now embracing this as primarily probably a commercial venture, but they're embracing it as well as a planetary ideal. Obama shares that ideal, not just with the Chinese, but with everyone. And I believe that that can become the locus for the other face of Obama. Obama right now, his face is being monopolized by national events. In order for him to become Queequeg, he has to be able to disclose the dream of his father, which is right now occluded by the anxiety of his mother from 68.
We've covered a lot of ground, from Herman Melville and Moby Dick to Joseph O'Neill, Barack Obama, China, the Green Movement. Donald Pease, thank you.
Thank you, Chris. This has been fun.
Sarah Archambault and Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, feedback at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.